Mrs. Mather, we want to thank you and the clinic at the University of Chicago for taking the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to your client and to the court. Thanks very much. Our third case this morning is Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association against American Express. Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rick Godfrey. I represent the association. As the court knows, this is an appeal from an unsuccessful attempt by the association to enforce a settlement agreement that had been reached resolving the original underlying litigation. I know that the court is familiar with the issues, and so I'd like to make three simple points, if I might, with respect to the merits.
Long before we get to the merits,
I was expecting that, Your Honor.
There are jurisdictional questions, starting with a question that neither side has addressed, which is whether the district court had any authority to make its decision, the one you are now appealing, while an appeal was pending in this court. And the proposition from Griggs against Provident Consumer Discount Company that an appeal deprives the district court of any authority to act on the matter under review on appeal is pretty fundamental. And the decision in this case was rendered while an appeal was pending. And if one takes Griggs, that decision is not simply avoidable. It is void. Where do we go from there?
You're right. Either side briefed that. And Your Honor's put your finger on an issue that I must say I have not considered. I know that before the judgment was entered, that's on appeal, that the appeal was dismissed in this court. And I know that at least one member of this court or a panel, whoever had that appeal, directed us to answer in the briefs three specific questions, which we attempted to do, and both sides took different positions. But I must confess, Your Honor, without researching that further, I don't have an answer for that question. And I think it is a fundamental question in terms of there's a timing issue here in the sense that the judgment here postdated the dismissal in the, I believe, like 2 days in the original appeal. But under the Griggs rule, I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. I think that's something that...
Then there's another jurisdictional question, which parties have also not addressed and wasn't in our jurisdictional order. But I don't understand what all of this to and fro is about. Aren't the parties of diverse citizenship?
Yes, and I was going to comment on that.
So why are we having this fight about supplemental jurisdiction when it appears there would be jurisdiction as an original matter to enforce this settlement contract?
Yes, and I was going to comment on that in that the evidence in the record, and it's from Mr. Mee, an American Express person under this court's rule opinion, is that American Express values the amount at stake for $17 million. Whether we agree with that is irrelevant. So their diverse citizenship, they clearly meet the jurisdictional minimum amount in controversy, and it seemed to me that the Jessup case was somewhat analogous.
On the one hand, this whole jurisdictional dispute appears to be beside the point. Everything, almost everything that parties have fought about in the district court is irrelevant. But the one thing the district court finally did, it appears to have had no authority to do.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the latter, but I don't have an answer to Your Honor's precatory question, which is...
Perhaps it would be a good idea for the parties to file supplemental jurisdictional briefs, supplementing the now several sets of jurisdictional memos and briefs, addressing two questions. First, whether the district court had jurisdiction over this dispute under the diversity statute, 1332.
Yes.
And if necessary, if necessary, in order to pin down the amount in controversy and the party's citizenship, there is a statute, it's 28 U.S.C. 1367, which allows the parties to amend their pleadings, even in the Court of Appeals, to show the existence of jurisdiction. So an amendment to show diversity in the amount in controversy is proper under 1367. And that's one option you can take. So that's one question. Is there subject matter jurisdiction and diversity? And the second question is whether under Griggs and its successors, the decision of the district court, the one that's particularly before us on appeal, is void.
Yes, sir.
We may have to go through this again. Doesn't give me any pleasure, but we may have to do it.
Yes, I anticipated starting here this morning with Your Honor. On the first point, our position is that I'm not even sure an amendment is required in that the record is very clear about both the diversity of the citizenship of the parties, and the record is very clear both from a documentary evidentiary standpoint plus testimony that under the Uhl case, American Express valued the amount in controversy at $17 million plus.
Mm-hmm.
On the second question, I don't have an answer at the moment, and I must confess that's an interesting question, and I wish I had thought of that before this morning's argument, but I did not. In terms of the merits, Your Honor, I was going to make three simple points. Number one, if you look at the contract by its plain terms, paragraph 5, it's about as clear as a language that you could write. It can't use the word blue. It says the word blue. And so the district court says if that's the only provision in the contract, it's unambiguous and it's enforced. But the court looks to other provisions which are not parallel, which address different subjects, and then says there's an ambiguity there. And our position on that is those provisions deal with different subjects and they're not parallel. But more importantly, what does paragraph 5 mean then under the district court's ruling? It's essentially been written out of the contract. If you think about your credit card and if
suppose you're right about that, the district court had a second reason, which was latches. The word blue has been on the card all along, and it took the Blues, your clients, 5 years to complain. Isn't that?
Well, but that doesn't address the blue cash, which was added new, and that was the triggering event. Plus, my client did not know. I think that the authorities are pretty clear that there had to be knowledge that they knew that the cards would be continued to be issued with the word blue. They thought that on a rolling basis going forward that the word blue would not be in the telephone number. But going back to my threshold point on the contract itself, for paragraph 5 is rendered meaningless.
That, I understand, that's an argument one might make to a district court.
Yes.
But what compels the district court to believe it? The district judge said, if I paraphrase him, look, I'm willing to cut your client some slack in not immediately jumping down American Express's throat for failing to remove the word blue from the card. But 5 years was too much, especially when new business decisions are taken while your client is asleep.
But the new business decisions only took in place in late 2003, and that was to add blue cash onto the front of the card, which is a fundamentally different violation. The Bacopian case, we think, is telling. We think the LaSalle National Bank case is telling on that. Plus, the fact of the matter is this case is unique in that American Express never relied on the settlement agreement. Latches requires prejudicial reliance. And the district court found that the American Express testimony was not credible. And more importantly,
How did American Express excuse it? It looked like it just filed it and forgot about it.
That's exactly what the court found. And the court said that's exactly what happened. They signed it, they filed it away, and no one ever thought about it again. And my client wrote a letter, which is at A95 of the appendix, in 2001 about blue for music and reminding them that the term blue can't appear on the card. And they had no idea that this violation was taking place. But latches, remember, requires reliance. It requires actual knowledge, and my client has set on its rights. And I think under the authorities that those standards have not been met as a matter of law.
How long after, was there an advertising campaign which focused on the blue color?
The advertising campaign for blue cash, according to American Express, started by direct mail in September of 2003. My client became aware of it when they saw it on TV in April of 2004. They promptly conducted an investigation that led to a July 27th, 2004 letter saying cease and desist under paragraph 8 of the settlement agreement, and American Express continued forward and did nothing in response. The only other point I would make is let's assume we get to extrinsic evidence. Assume that there's an ambiguity, which we dispute. The court says, well, The extrinsic evidence cuts both ways, so I'm going to look at the post-settlement agreement conduct, and we've already covered that. But the extrinsic evidence doesn't cover both ways. The court starts with the premise that the word alone, after Blue, was the idea of Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. That's simply wrong as a matter of undisputed fact. If you look at A50, which is the first draft by the American Express Association, the third whereas clause at the top of the page says, whereas the parties wish to resolve the litigation in all matters concerning the respective use and registration of the word blue. And then paragraph 4, where American Express writes in, American Express will not apply to register blue alone. American Express was the one who came up with the concept of the necessity of specifying blue versus blue alone. And then if you look at A60, which is the responsive, A61, which is a responsive proposal by Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, we copy the whereas clause and parody that. You then combine that with the undisputed testimony by Ms. McDermott, the author and who signed it for American Express, at page A182 and A181 of the appendix, in which she added the word alone to paragraph 3 of the final draft after blue because she says, without it, I can't use the word blue at all. And then she says, to top it off, my drafting protocol was to delete words and only add them when it's important. So the district court's premise on extrinsic evidence that it started with, that the word alone and the blue alone concept came from Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, is simply wrong based on the undisputed record before the court. I'll reserve the rest of my time, and I'll think about the Griggs issue, Your Honor, but I'm not sure I'm going to have an answer by the time my rebuttal comes up. So.
Thank you, Mr. Godfrey.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, Lou Smith appearing on behalf of American Express. Your Honor, with regard to the Griggs issue, I understand we'll be addressing that in supplemental briefing, but as I see the issue, Your Honor, the appeal was taken from the granting of a Rule 60A motion, which we viewed as a final order. That is the order that ended the trademark litigation. It dismissed the underlying case with prejudice. What happened after that is enforcement action, and that everything that was happening at the district court was enforcement activity. So we filed a notice of appeal. It brought the underlying trademark case, which was finished up by the Rule 60A decision, before this court, but that does not divest the district court from dealing with enforcement activity
As you're well aware, there was a very serious dispute about whether that was a final decision, and therefore whether that was an apt way of describing things. If this were just a a Rule 67 enforcement proceeding, there wouldn't be any problem about supplemental jurisdiction to start with. The problem was not that people were trying to enforce the district court's order. The problem was that it wasn't in the district court's order. The district court makes this decision, which it characterizes as a Rule 60A decision, but couldn't possibly have been, as the basis for bringing something in, for making an initial order, which it could then do something about, which suggested, of course, that proceedings were ongoing, and as we know, they were ongoing. Now, the tough question from Griggs, from the perspective of Griggs, is under what circumstances does an interlocutory appeal, that is, a notice of appeal taken without jurisdiction, activate the Griggs rule?
Your Honor, that's something that I'll have to address in the context of our supplemental briefing.
It's complicated because since this court the last time, the appeal was dismissed voluntarily before we had an opportunity to throw it out for want of jurisdiction. We, of course, have never determined that there was no jurisdiction on your appeal. So perhaps you need to address the Griggs question on two hypotheses. One, that there was jurisdiction over that appeal, and the other, that it was an unauthorized appeal outside the court's jurisdiction, as, of course, Blue Cross Blue Shield was contending at the time.
Thank you, Your Honor. We will address that, and with regard to the issue of underlying subject matter jurisdiction, we agree with the association that the parties are diverse, that the amount of controversy far exceeds the jurisdictional.
So why were you fighting about this in the district court? What was the point of this fight? All this stuff about supplemental jurisdiction and Rule 60A and whether the amendment was proper is totally beside the point if there was diversity jurisdiction all along. You were wasting your money. You were wasting our time. It's a total squandering of resources to have fought that issue.
Well, Your Honor, the way the issue came up was in light of this court's post-Kekkonen decisions.
Yes, but it's if whether there is jurisdiction under the supplemental jurisdiction is utterly irrelevant if there's diversity jurisdiction. It matters only when there's no diversity jurisdiction. And since the parties agree that there was diversity jurisdiction, there was no point to this fight. Right? It's a total waste of everybody's time and money. You're entitled to waste as much of your money as you wish or as your client will tolerate, but you shouldn't be wasting your adversary's time and money, and you certainly shouldn't be wasting ours.
Well, Your Honor, when this issue arose at the district court level, the district court raised with the association and indicated, why don't you resolve any jurisdictional issue by filing a complaint? The association refused to do that. They did not file a complaint, and instead they pressed on with their 60A motion, which the court then decided and set off this chain of events. So we identified this issue early and raised it with the district court. The district court raised it with the association and advised that that they could file a complaint and remove any issue around it. They refused to do that. They just continued to press and go forward with the case, and that's the situation that is presently before the court.
The situation that's presently before the court is one in which you knew that there was subject matter jurisdiction under 1332, and you nonetheless filed an interlocutory appeal asking us to hold there was no subject matter jurisdiction.
Your Honor, our view of the issue was that we felt it was an appeal of a final order, and it was distinct from the enforcement proceedings that were going on. It closed out the trademark proceedings. I understand that the association took a different view of that, but we respectfully disagreed with their approach and believed that that was a final order, and we either had to appeal it within 30 days or not at all. Your Honor, with regard to the merits, I understand the jurisdiction is going to be revisited in subsequent briefing, but with regard to the merits, the standard of review,
which will be, I think, the fourth set of briefs, because if I recall correctly, we had to have two sets of preliminary memos in the first appeal, and then we wrapped that up by issuing the order requiring more jurisdictional memos. And in the end, it's all going to wash out, although I suspect it's going to mean you're going to have to relitigate this case before another district judge. Because now that Judge Zagel has actually entered this, Circuit Rule 36 will apply when we invoke, if we invoke, Griggs against Provident Consumer Discounts. So you'll be restarting it. And that this is deep pockets litigation personified.
Well, Your Honor, we feel that, and as we laid that in our brief, there is jurisdiction. The court has had jurisdiction when it entered its decision denying the enforcement motion. We follow the timeline, the initial 60A ruling, which we consider separate and related to the trademark. It wasn't divested of jurisdiction when the notice of appeal was filed. And as we lay out on our papers, Your Honor, and I understand this will be addressed more fully in an additional brief, but we respectfully submit that at the end of this, we argue and
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say Judge Zagel. I should have said Judge Cannelli.
It was Judge Cannelli. Yeah. Yes. Your Honor, turning to the merits, this was an application to enforce a settlement agreement. There's no dispute in the papers that the controlling standard of review is a very, very deferential one. So this court, it's an abuse of discretion standard, which as interpreted in this context means the question is not whether Your Honors agree with what Judge Cannelli did.
Abuse of discretion in reading a contract is not the standard that we use. The meaning of a contract is a legal issue. Abuse of discretion is the standard for latches. But I'm worried, you know, I think your principal obstacle on latches is detrimental reliance. If, as the district judge found, American Express basically put this in its files, and they were kind of like the National Archives, things go in, they never come out, right? So there it is, How could there be detrimental reliance on a particular understanding of paragraph 5 when the document was forgotten about?
There was detrimental reliance, Your Honor, because it was the association's witnesses testified that immediately after the settlement agreement was entered into, American Express was in breach. They interpret paragraph 5 of the settlement agreement, which says American Express shall not use the word blue alone on its credit cards, to mean American Express shall not use the word blue alone or in combination with any other terms on its credit cards.
That goes to notice. That doesn't go to detrimental reliance.
But Your Honor, they never conveyed that view to American Express. American Express, from immediately after the settlement agreement was signed, never changed what it did with its cards.
Under what legal principle were they required to convey that view?
Well, in terms of Latch's analysis,
the contract means what it says, and the meaning of the contract should be understood by all and attributable to all.
In terms of Latch's analysis, what the trial court found was, based on the testimony, that they thought that American Express was an immediate breach. They sat on their hands. They knew American Express in 2000, in 1999, and forever going forward, was issuing cards where the word blue appeared on the physical credit card. They knew that. They felt it was a breach. They never brought that to American Express's attention.
But there isn't any evidence to support the fact that your client relied on a different interpretation.
My client, the people involved with negotiating the settlement, testified that they understood paragraph 5 to mean that it only affected the use of blue alone on the credit card. And one of the things that they relied on was the fact that blue had always appeared on the credit card. The association, during settlement negotiations, never raised the fact that they wanted blue to be removed from the credit card. The issue never came up. So they relied on the fact that blue, in 1999, 2000, going forward, every step
of the way. So it was a got-you settlement agreement, right? You just prevail on the settlement agreement. It didn't mean nothing to American Express.
Well, it precluded, paragraph 5 precluded American Express from using the term blue alone on the credit card. It did have an impact within the context of the settlement agreement. They could not issue.
Well, it didn't change anything for you, though, did it?
It did not require American Express
to do anything.
It did not require them to change their existing plastic as it was in the marketplace. That is correct. American Express prevailed on the underlying preliminary injunction motion. This was a settlement agreement that the parties reached where the association was not in a strong position coming in. And American Express did give up certain things in the context of the settlement agreement, but changing their
plastic. What did American Express give up?
They gave up their ability to use the word blue alone on its credit cards.
What about paragraph 5?
That's in paragraph 5.
That's not the language of paragraph 5.
Paragraph 5 says don't use the term blue, period.
Paragraph 5 says American Express should not use the word blue on its credit cards. Paragraph 6 says American Express should not use the word blue alone or in combination.
I don't think you rarely hear sort of the take of lawyer talk or lawyer speak, but that's just it, right?
Your Honor,
blue doesn't mean blue. Blue means blue alone.
The trial court properly reviewed the settlement agreement as a whole, and when you review the settlement agreement as a whole, you see that blue is being used in very different ways. There is blue alone or in combination with any other terms. There's just blue, and then there's blue alone. American Express contended that the settlement agreement should be interpreted so that blue means blue alone. The association contended that the settlement agreement should be interpreted so that blue means blue alone or in combination with any other terms. And the district court properly and reasonably found, in light of these various uses of blue, looking at the settlement agreement as a whole, which you're required to do under Illinois law, that the settlement agreement was ambiguous. And thus he resorted to extrinsic evidence. And the extrinsic evidence, as you continue to look at more information, more evidence about what was going on, further supported American Express's view of how this settlement agreement should properly be interpreted, in particular paragraph 5. So, Your Honor, a point that the association makes in its papers and stresses is you should just read this paragraph in isolation. There's absolutely no support in the law for that proposition. The law
I don't understand their argument in that way. I understand the argument to be this language means what it says, and the fact that the word blue is used in different ways in different non-parallel provisions in the contract doesn't make paragraph 5 ambiguous. That's different from what you're saying.
Well,
you're
Honor,
spinning it very differently.
Well, first of all, I would say when you're looking at these provisions, they are parallel. They're all dealing with how American Express uses Blue in the context of marketing this credit card product. And secondly, the law requires, unless it's a totally different contract, as this court found in the TerraCorp case, which is cited in the briefs, the court found if what you're saying is you don't want us to look at the contract as a whole to determine the meaning of provisions, then what you're saying is it's a totally separate contract, in effect.
No, even looking at the contract as a whole, if the use of the word blue in other provisions in the contract is different and non-parallel and deals with different subjects and contains different modifiers, then it doesn't make paragraph 5 ambiguous.
Well, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that if that were followed, then it would eliminate the principle that a contract must be construed as a whole and you must interpret each provision in relation to other provisions in the agreement. That's what all the cases say. That's what the law requires. And to say that it's non-parallel or it's touching on a different point would eliminate that well-recognized principle of contract law. It requires, in figuring out what this blue means, you have to look at, and it right in the whereas clause, right at the beginning.
Only if it's ambiguous in the first instance.
But this is the analysis that goes on in order to make the determination as to whether or not it is ambiguous. And so you can't determine that it's ambiguous simply by looking at just the paragraph in isolation. But
I'm not suggesting that. Even looking at paragraph 5 in the context of the entire contract, it's unambiguous because the use of the word blue elsewhere in the contract is different and deals with different subjects and contains different modifiers.
Your Honor, I would.
And the differences don't render paragraph 5 on its face ambiguous, so we don't have to get to anything else.
Well, I would also point out to Your Honor that in the first whereas clause, which is the first time blue, just in quotes, appears in the settlement agreement, it says American Express is currently using the terms blue or blue from American Express to identify credit card services. That plainly means blue alone. Because if it didn't mean blue alone, then there would be no reason to have blue from American Express to follow. So in order to have a consistent meaning throughout, referring to this first use of blue, which is in a section dealing with definitional terms and setting up the agreement, you would interpret it to mean blue alone. And I respectfully would urge that the district court's analysis on this issue was correct and should be evaluated on an abuse of discretion standard.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Godfrey?
First point, paragraph 5 has to mean something. And paragraphs 3, 4, 5, and 6 are not parallel. They address different subjects. But there's another point that I want to make, which is paragraph 5 is the only one that says you can't use the word blue. Paragraph 3 talks about registering the terms blue. Paragraph 4 refers to the terms. Paragraph 5 says to the word blue. And paragraph 6 says to the term. Because when you register trademarks, you're registering terms, whereas this contract prohibits the use of the word blue, period. Second point, you don't rewrite a contract. If it meant blue alone, Ms. McDermott knew how to write the word alone in. She wrote it in. She did it in her first draft. She did it in her second draft. And she did it in the final draft. Because she testified at A181 and A182, if I didn't do that, then I couldn't use the word blue. Now, you never get to extrinsic evidence, Your Honor's point, because it's unambiguous on its face. But if you get to extrinsic evidence, the drafting history, which the district court inexplicably ignored on the first draft from American Express, and the testimony of Ms. McDermott is dispositive. Those are admissions. Final point. Interpretation of a whole I have never seen before to be used to create a contract ambiguity and an otherwise plain and unambiguous term that the district court says if that's all the contract has, then the association is correct. TerraCorp doesn't hold that. We would obviously ask the court to reverse this. We understand there's a jurisdictional question, and I once briefed pre-Grig, but I don't remember what the answer was there, and I don't think that's going to be relevant. So we'll figure out the answer, Your Honor, and we'll get the briefs on file.
We will give you 10 days to get these jurisdictional filings on file.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our fourth case for argument this morning is